As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello, thank you for joining us this week on the Athletic Football Tactics podcast, where we have a simple task today. We'd like to give you the sharpest, most tactically astute breakdown of the Champions League round of 16, which concluded on Wednesday night ahead of the draw for the quarterfinals on Friday. I'm Ali Maxwell. To do that with me, Michael Cox.
Hi, Ali.
Hello, Liam Tharms here.
Hello, Ali.
And the returning Mark Carey.
Hello, Ali.
Great to have you back. All well?
All well. Thank you. Thank you for having me back. I'm glad I've been able to return.
Straight back into the starting 11. Duncan overexerted himself last week, picked up a small strain, and so you're straight back in. Look, we previewed the round of 16, and it feels right to recap it as well. Michael, one thing that sprang to mind when I thought about our preview was that we went into it hopeful that there could be some outsiders, not just getting through the round of 16, but going deep in the competition. It's not come to pass.
Yeah, sadly not. I hoped for one of Porto or PSV or Real Sociedad to go through. Sadly not. Porto obviously came closest, did well against Arsenal, took it to a penalty shootout. I always think extra time and penalties is a bit of home advantage there now, more than there used to be, where the away goal kind of balanced it out. But yeah, it's a fairly predictable final eight we've got, and indeed, you know, this was obviously group winners against group runners-up, and seven of the eight group winners went through. The only exceptions were PSG, and even then they would have been favourites against Real Sociedad. So I didn't think it was a terrible round, but it was quite predictable in the end.
Am I right in saying that you weren't thrilled about the removal of the away goals rule?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was great. There's some negatives to it. It did sometimes kill ties a little bit early. But in terms of the biggest moments, it was always when it happened, you know, you'd get that swing from one team winning to another team winning with just one goal, which you can only get in the away goal situation. So, yeah, I do think it is a shame. And I do think the Champions League has lost certainly some of its moments since that rule was scrapped. And I think, I mean, people will have their own opinions on whether it's good or bad. I think the real problem was getting rid of it during the time of COVID, when there'd been a lot of ties played on neutral venues. And you had a fairly ridiculous situation where often two ties or two legs of the tie would be played in the same place, and away goals would count for one team in one game and the other team in another game. And I think we all agree that was a little bit farcical. And I think maybe the decision was a little bit hasty on the basis of that.
We've got Manchester City, Arsenal, Bayern Munich, Barcelona, Real Madrid, Atletico Madrid, Dortmund and Paris Saint-Germain in the quarterfinals, the last day. And with a few debates to be had, if we had the time, broadly, Liam, these are eight of the biggest clubs in European football, the heavyweights. And there seems to be a bit of discussion online around whether this is something to be celebrated. We may be seeing the eight best teams in the world, give or take, playing against each other in Europe's premier competition. There's also other concerns about what it means about the competitive balance of European football. Do you lean either way here?
It's hard to say, because it kind of depends, because you want the big matchups at some point, right? It depends whether you sort of want them earlier on in the competition or, you know, in the groups. There was the argument about, okay, everyone loves a group of death, and then the impact is you then lose at least one of those teams when you've got, you know, three or four really top sides. Obviously, there's broader coefficient, I think, ramifications now, which people are more worried about, and I think scrambling every match day to do the maths as to who you might be getting sort of which slot. So, and I know we'll come into it as sort of a tie from a tactical perspective, but I think it was a real shame that we got Atletico and Inter at this stage, because they're two teams that, Mark and I were discussing this, could cause real problems for a lot of those other sides that you'd kind of like for them to meet maybe in the quarters or the semi-finals. Of course, it's, you have to play the draw. That's how sort of tournament football works. So yeah, you compare that to last season where Inter had more favourable draws throughout, and then, you know, didn't come up against maybe quite a heavyweight right until the final, whereas they had it earlier on this time. So that's the nature of it. I think there's, as Michael said with the away goals thing, there's pros and cons to both.
People don't want the top of European football to become a closed shop, Michael. They don't want the drawbridge pulled up. We want this idea of mobility or the potential to succeed from a lower position. And at the same time, we love watching the best teams play against each other. So that seems to be the obvious sort of parameters for this discussion. Where do you stand with the group that we have heading into the last eight being a good thing, or maybe not so much?
Yeah, I don't think they're all great sides. I mean, I don't think Barcelona are a great side. I know they're one of the major names in European football. Maybe this is the issue, that big clubs cannot be great and still get through. But I think that the quarterfinals onwards should be pretty good. I think there'll be some really interesting ties. And I think in years to come, people don't really remember how good the second round was. They remember the quarterfinal, semi-final, final. So I'm sure people will enjoy the next few rounds.
One of the quirks of the round of 16 was that two of our eight ties were decided with a penalty shootout. These were the first Champions League knockout round penalty shootouts, Mark, since the final in 2016.
Yeah, and it was really great to watch as well. I know that Michael has some interesting thoughts on the timing of the whistle blowing and the penalty actually subsequently being taken. And I always like to have my kind of prediction going into it, more so with the run-up, I think. You can sort of tell when and often this won't always be 100% right, but you can tell by the way that a player approaches it, whether it's a short run-up with conviction, whatever it may be, but also to, which I'm sure Michael will expand upon, the time taken between the whistle blowing and the actual penalty being taken. You got your own little pseudoscience of some mathematics to go with it, Michael.
Yeah, I mean, there's a very good book by Ben Littleton called 12 Yards, which is all about penalties. And I mean, he's been working with a database, I think, of tens of thousands of penalties. And there's obviously various little theories amongst that. But I think maybe the most interesting one, and the one that when I watch penalty shootouts really seems to play out this way, is the longer the distance between the whistle going and the start of the player's run up, or between the whistle and the actual kick, the more likely it is for players to score. And this is something that has clearly been relatively widely known over the last few years. I think players are taking longer than ever. It probably is less predictive than it used to be, because almost every player is doing that. But if you look at the Inter-Atleti penalties and the Arsenal-Porto penalties, yeah, the pattern is clear. I won't read them all out because it won't make for good podcasting. But if you want to see the timings and the success rates, then they're on my Twitter account.
Per your calculations, Bukayo Saka took 10.6 seconds to strike his penalty after the whistle blew. I mean, that is... where's it going to end? That's...
time wasting.
You talk about good podcasting, bad podcasting. I'm tempted to blow a whistle and wait for 10 seconds so we can see exactly how long that feels.
Yeah. Usain Bolt could...
I was waiting for this.
No, I mean, McAllister the weekend against City, that was really long. Mm. I mean, I haven't timed that yet. I will do after this pod, but I reckon that was about 15 seconds.
Well, that's what I was going to say in terms of there's a difference. I know Liam's spoken about this in the past, about the time taken between a penalty being awarded in sort of normal play versus the penalty being taken, and the weight between that of the pressure building around the stadium for the player to actually take the penalty. That feels almost like it's out of their control, because often there's a scramble around the penalty area, whatever, versus the taking the control from when the whistle's blown to then taking it. It feels like that's very, very conscious. And I think there's been a higher incidence of players, I can only sort of describe it as running on the spot before taking it as well. They just really kind of get the legs going as well, rather than almost having shaky legs and the first two steps being a little bit unbalanced, shall we say. And I think the Saka one included that as well. There was far more, a higher rate of players doing that as well. So it feels like it's so much more conscious, and players will continue to practice them ahead of more knockout rounds.
It's probably worth mentioning here that we've actually done a whole pod semi-recently on penalties, so people should go check that out. Explains all the stuff around the wait times and how that's kind of just more an indication of, I think, sort of the anxiety to take it, or the, you know, lacking maybe the composure. And I was very worried with Lautaro Martinez as he ran up, on the basis that he struggled to pick the ball up properly first as well, go into it. He just seemed very sort of clumsy and quite nervous. You do worry there's quite a lot of confirmation bias with this sort of thing, where you're sort of, you think you know something, so you're looking for that to sort of manifest itself. It felt like a real treat, to be honest, after quite a good sort of tactical spectacle. It was just good fun.
I think I was a bit guilty of the penalty guesswork confirmation bias with Klaassen's penalty for Inter, where I thought to myself, he doesn't look comfortable, he's gone too quickly, and then of course it was saved. And you watch the replay and you think, that is objectively quite a good penalty in terms of the power in the placement, and just an absurd grab by Jan Oblak, who ends up the star in the end. Liam, a tie, won with such a small margin as Atletico Inter was, 2-2 on aggregate. Simeone versus Simone Inzaghi. How did it play out over the two legs?
It's a really great tie. It had kind of everything rolled into one, from the first leg where Inter were really, really good, should have scored more already in terms of the quality of chances that they made and how they long really they took to break down Atleti with a real, you know, fluid build-up approach. And I was sort of saying to Mark earlier on this morning that it was kind of the perfect balance for a second leg going into that, because Inter had a lead, but it was so sort of fine as only a singular goal that you don't know really whether to be conservative and how long you try and defend that lead, because Atleti are a really, really good team at home. I think they've won all bar one of their league games at home this season. And their knockout home record, I believe, in Europe is phenomenal as well. So with that and the atmosphere and, you know, two teams playing in a tactically similar-ish way, which on paper you put them as a sort of 3-5-2, but with a kind of number 10 playing off a number 9 and very fluid sort of build-up approaches. So Atleti were playing Axel Witsel, obviously normally someone that people might see as a central midfielder, but has been playing centre-back this season. Dealt really well up against one of the best front twos, I think, sort of really in Europe, particularly in terms of bringing those long balls down from the goalkeeper or the back line. Inter struggled to really get in behind to release the wing-backs. They dropped Nico Barea quite deep a lot as well. Mm. Sort of once they got out of the initial press when Atleti were going man for man, they dropped into a 5-4-1. And I think they sort of struggled. Ironically, the goal comes from Barea making one of those sort of trademark beyond the ball runs. They seem kind of in between two phases of, do we attack and try and get a second? Or did we sort of sit off and try and control the game a little bit more? It was really quite intense as a game. The big downside for Inter is how good they've been this season. They've had a perfect 2024 as a calendar year before this game. And the two goals they conceded were really poor defensively. They were carved apart, one through an error, and I think one just through fatigue at the end of the game, which for a team that defends so well in a low block and a 5-3-2, you don't concede chances where you're, you know, carved apart through the middle like that.
Yeah, very even tie overall. Atleti heading into the last eight. I always am pleased when Diego Simeone is present in the latter stages of the Champions League, as he has been so often over the last decade or so. And then Arsenal-Porto, which was also decided on a penalty shootout. 1-1 on aggregate. A lot of praise for Porto's tactical approach and the way that they saw it through, really, over two legs and falling short on penalties.
Yeah, I think that's something which has kind of been key from this week, that a lot of people may be saying that Arsenal struggled to break down Porto's block, and maybe seeing that as a weakness of Arsenal's. But you do have to sometimes give credit to the opponent and just say that Porto was super strong. And their whole games and performances this season has been built on a really strong defensive foundation. So they've conceded 0.68 goals per 90 in the Premier League this season, and that's comfortably the best of any side in Portugal. And I should have checked to see how much, you know, how good that is across the wider top seven European leagues, because it must be up there as one of the best. So it's no coincidence that Porto are so strong defensively, but I think it's the fact that it's just contrasted with one of Arsenal's main weaknesses this season is struggling to break down mid blocks and low blocks. And I'd say both mid block and low block, it was probably more a low block at times in the return leg, but definitely more of a mid block in the first leg. And I wrote a piece on it of just how strong Porto were from the very first minute. You could see in the first leg just how strong they were in being really compact, and they forced Arsenal to go around them at times. They suggested, just could Arsenal go over them, which they didn't really take the bait on, but rarely ever through them. And they were so compact, and there was no space in central areas. And the only time there was a bit of space for Martin Odegaard, that was when he sort of threaded that ball through for Trossard. So you got to give credit to Porto first and foremost.
Arsenal were quite devastating at home in their three group games. I think they scored 12 and hardly conceded a shot, let alone a goal in the groups. And part of that was because of how well they could press, and teams actually did come there and say, well, you know, we will try to play and try and build them. So people saw recently against Newcastle as well, another example of a Champions League level team that came there and tried to build, and just how relentless they are, how well structured and well coordinated and timed their presses, and all the right profiles of having Odegaard with phenomenal stamina to keep making those sprints, centre-backs that can defend high upfield. So Porto's build-up really interested me, because it wasn't purely a case of, okay, have all the ball, we're going to sit back, we're just going to push the line up and sort of kick for territory. It was two really wide centre-backs, really split, I think at times almost into the channels, like outside the width of the box, playing Diogo Costa, who's, you know, a great distributor, quite high, still played direct quite a lot, but I think the premise was, give those front two for Arsenal, so Havertz and Odegaard, sort of bigger spaces to press, to say, okay, you're going to have to make a 30, 35-yard sprint, not just a 15, 20-yard one. So one, you should get more tired, and two, it's harder to do again and again. So you could either get out down the sides, and they'd quite aggressively position fullbacks as a result of that. So then Arsenal's wingers sort of get pinned in quite deep. And when they were then going on, they could sort of pick up second balls. Yeah. And okay, they didn't stick a whole lot, but when the ball did drop and Arsenal did play back round, then Porto could press themselves. So you didn't get these sort of waves that Arsenal have had in a lot of their Premier League games, where it's been Arsenal attack, and just penning a team in. They did get out quite well, and Arsenal looked shaky for a decent portion of that.
Yeah, there was a moment in the first half, I think, and we've spoken about Arsenal's 4-4-2 out of possession being so strong, as you say, Liam, with Odegaard kind of leading it, that Porto spread the centre-backs really wide, and Rice was kind of backing up the two of them but didn't quite know how to or whether to, because there was so much space. And I think Costa just played, it wasn't even a floated ball, it was a kind of a driven ball on the floor straight into Conceição, I think, on the halfway line with a single pass, and they were on almost a artificial transition where it looked like they were counter-attacking against Arsenal from one pass. So yeah, Arsenal's press wasn't as strong, but they found a way in the end.
I haven't heard artificial transition before, and I like it, because talking, as I do, about the EFL as well, and talking about the way that tactics are changing, there are now quite a lot of examples of goals where, if you just watch the last few actions, it looks like it's been a counter-attack because the defensive backpedaling, and clearly there's space to play into. But so often, and I think of Ipswich Town, who are one of the standout teams in the Championship at the moment, so often it's they themselves that have created those opportunities. It's not actually the ball hasn't changed hands and then there's been a quick counter-attack. They've worked it all the way from the back. And I think that's interesting, because it doesn't always feel like a build-up attack, but of course it is in some ways as well. So artificial transition, I'm adding that to the lexicon. A couple of Porto bits as well. We had a really impressive individual display from their fullback Wendell.
Yeah, really, really good. Not many people go 1v1. Again, lots of reasons why teams play the way they do against Arsenal is so they can double up on wide areas to mark sort of 2v1 against Saka, against Martinelli or Trossard. And obviously, in the Premier League game just gone, it was how they then used Ben White either on the overlap or in sort of deeper positions to cross and solve that. But he was great. I was really enjoying Adam McCoy's commentary. Just his adoration for that sort of performance was really quite good fun. So it maybe shows the jump up that you do get of players athletically or on individual levels of technical and tactical ability at the top level, Champions League wise. Sure, Saka's played World Cups. You know, he's by no means inexperienced. But I think specifically, and sort of the knockout level, yeah, that players on a player-by-player basis, the floor is so, so high.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And it was reported, Michael, on social media in particular, that Porto's warm-up was unusual, quite specific.
Yeah, just defending set pieces they were practicing, apparently, which is remarkable, really. And I think it's interesting because, you know, usually the 10 years ago, the big sides, the technical sides, it'd be set pieces where they maybe could be undone, whereas it's now a big strength of theirs. So, yeah, I haven't seen that before.
I must say, so I was at the game and I loved watching it.
Was it already noticeable?
I recorded it on my phone because I was just captivated by it. But I must say, the caveat to it was that maybe some of the stuff going around on social media was kind of a wide free kick or a corner sort of cross going in, and that was how they were sort of defending them. But early on when I was watching the warm-up, it was more that they were the coach was doing it from, let's say, between the halfway line and the penalty area, from slightly wide. But I think the idea was kind of being that we're going to contain us, we're going to keep in a contained block, and we're going to force Arsenal into maybe deep crosses or wherever it is, because they're not going to go through our block. And the reason I think it was interesting was because they kept their line really well, and it was all about the triggers of dropping off and when to push forward and stuff. But Pepe and Conceição were part of that warm-up or part of that routine as well, because they were placed, 10, 15 yards further forward to get the second balls and to then go and start to counterattack if they could. So it was very conscious, obviously, not just to be like, we're just going to defend and think about ways to control set pieces, but think about, okay, well, when we get our head onto this and we get first contact, we're going to be the first to collect the second ball and then transition and go forward from there. So I thought it was actually quite an offensive strategy as well.
Part of me thinks it all might just be a massive smokescreen as well. Right. And I'd love to know Ali's perspective on this from the EFL side of things, where I can't imagine Mikel Arteta sat there on the touchline watching he's probably not even out there, the assistants I imagine will be doing it, and being like, oh, this is how they're warming up, so suddenly we're going to rip up all of our, game plan and opposition analysis. My logic on it always is it's activation, it's getting players prepared to play. And it isn't. There's like interesting tactical detail in it. Absolutely, and it's really insightful. I think maybe the average fan or someone on social media sees that and goes, "Oh, this is exactly their game plan that they're replicating now that they're going to show off an hour before." And the coach is probably like, "Yeah, not quite like that."
Interesting. Last thing on Arsenal, Liam. In our preview, we discussed the fact that Arsenal, in the bookmakers' eyes, I think were joint third favourites to win the Champions League, and that was sort of put up against the fact that they don't have a lot of recent European experience. So now we've seen them struggle to an extent to get past Porto, only on a penalty shootout. And, maybe that would have been confirmation of those who think things like Champions League experience is actually a very big factor that isn't always taken into account.
I mean, this is entirely arbitrary, but I had a quick look at their sort of experience across the squad and looked at the number of players they've got with 30 or more Champions League appearances. So, again, I've not factored in other European competitions, internationals, but I wanted to see that as a benchmark. Arsenal have 5 players with at least 30 appearances in the Champions League. 3 of those didn't start the game. So those 3 are Gabriel Jesus, Alexander Zinchenko and Thomas Partey. The 2 that did were Jorginho and Kai Havertz. That's comfortably the lowest of any of the last 8 teams remaining. You've got second fewest after them is Barcelona with 9, or sorry, Dortmund with 7, then Barcelona with 9, and you go all the way up to Bayern, who've got 16, City have 11, PSG 11, Atleti 13. So on an individual basis, yeah, there are fewer players and also fewer possibly starters as well. You can factor in within that you've got Champions League winners in Kai Havertz and Jorginho, and obviously the Champions League final match winner in Kai Havertz. So it sort of depends how you look at it. I'd also make the argument that they feel quite cohesive as a team and as a unit and as a squad, and have gelled in those signings from sort of last January or the previous windows really, really well. So
yeah, individually maybe not quite as experienced as others, but they look a real team.
Michael, do you think it stands to reason that when we're weighing up all the variables that go into success in football, that when we talk about the Champions League knockout specifically, experience of Champions League knockouts equals nous equals better performance and execution in the very, very biggest games?
Yeah, probably. I think two-legged ties are different to just playing a one-off league game. And it's about the manager as well. Arteta hasn't managed at this level before. So, yeah, I think it probably is a small factor.
Manchester City, the holders, beating FC Copenhagen 6-2. Michael, as comfy as the scoreline suggests?
Yeah, this was the least interesting fixture on paper and probably the least interesting tie, even if there were 8 goals over the two legs. It was the strongest side against the weaker side, I think. And if you like that kind of thing, that's probably what we're going to get next year, because with the Swiss model and the new system of the Champions League, there will be a bracket rather than a draw for the final stage of the Champions League, and teams will be ranked according to their group stage, inverted commas, group stage performance, because it won't be a group stage. I think probably the only two interesting things were, again, to replicate what I said about Arsenal, City was such a threat from set pieces, particularly at the start of the second leg. Traditionally, you'd think Copenhagen going away to Man City, maybe a couple of set pieces could cause problems, but absolutely not. It was the reverse. And Copenhagen's goalkeeper was very poor at dealing with high balls. And the other thing was that I thought Julian Alvarez played very well on the left against Copenhagen in the second game. And I wonder whether that convinced Guardiola to use him there in the next game against Liverpool, where actually I thought he was quite poor on the left, just kept on conceding possession, wasn't very good defensively against Conor Bradley as well. So that was maybe an interesting feature of it, but yeah, a bit of a procession really.
Only some quick numbers to add to what Michael's saying is that across the whole of the Champions League this season, Man City have generated 6.4 expected goals per 100 set pieces. So when given equal opportunity for all teams across the competition, they are the best, than better than any other side in the competition this season. So yeah, just to support Michael's point, really, that, you know, for all that we think about Manchester City being so strong in open play, they've got unbelievable players. We know from the Premier League as well just how strong they are from set pieces, and the numbers back it up.
Real Madrid got through 2-1 on aggregate against RB Leipzig. Mark, one of the Real Madrid Champions League narratives over the last many years now is, don't always look great, but get the job done.
It was exactly that. I really think it was. I think it was interesting to hear what Liam said before about the Inter-Atleti game, where, you know, Madrid were 1-0 up from the first leg, so they didn't need to really push too much. And it felt kind of like a big brother maybe holding the little brother by the head at arm's length. If you're like, well, you can start swinging, but we're just going to keep things in control. And if you maybe do catch us, then we'll maybe step it up a little bit. And it
didn't expect any childhood trauma during this recording, but thanks, Mark. That's hit me hard.
Genuinely off the top of my head, but which is ironic, but it did just sort of feel like that. I mean, Leipzig as well, it must be said that they did generate quite a lot of chances. They had 14 shots in the second leg, and across both legs, their expected goals suggested they should have scored about 2 to 3 goals rather than the one that they obviously did score. And I think they were just a little bit wasteful at times. I mean, Lois Openda has been a really good forward, a really good signing in the summer, has scored well, not amazing, but well in the Bundesliga. And he had so many opportunities. And if not a poor finish, it was sometimes just making the wrong decision at the wrong time. And Benjamin Sesko, I think we spoke about him after the first leg as well, he was just a little bit wasteful in front of goal. So there was a lot of, yeah, wastefulness.
But was there a common thread of how those chances were created, if we're looking forward and looking at potential weaknesses to exploit for Real Madrid's next opposition? Was there an obvious type of chance they were creating?
They got in behind quite a few times. We know that Leipzig are typically direct in the way that they like to play, and they did get in behind a few times. There wasn't many sort of one-on-one clear cuts of chances, but a couple were caught offside as well. But I don't think there's anything that Madrid did specifically that is a real weakness. Mm-hmm. But I do, similar to what we spoke about last time, I do think that Madrid, if they want to play a certain way, you know, if they want to play direct, they can. If they want to play a bit more possession-based, they can. So they didn't have a ton of shots themselves, 11 shots, so they were outshot across the game. But yeah, it feels, what I think is interesting is that it feels like, as we said before, it's typical of Madrid in seasons gone by, and that they ultimately just have really good players who will make the difference. And I think it's interesting to think of that in the Champions League sense, because they've been so successful in the Champions League in so many seasons gone by. And I think that's perhaps why they've done so well in the competition, because they just have individual stars who can make the difference, which I know Michael has spoken about before. And you compare that with the La Liga titles that they've had. They've only won 4 La Liga titles in the past 15 seasons. And yes, they're going to probably go on and win a fifth this season. But when you think about how dominant they've been in Europe, you think that they would also tally, that they'd also be so dominant in their domestic league. Mm-hmm. But because of the nature of their, maybe their style, predicated on just individual quality largely and an element of pragmatism, it's quite interesting to contrast that from the league level to obviously the Champions League level, where they've been doing so well across many years.
It goes to show just how good City were last season to balance stuff on multiple fronts. Inter, again, to link back to them, another example of, you know, winning Serie A an absolute canter this season and jumping over all those, you know, bars before that they couldn't quite maintain and sort of sustain performance, and now obviously then have gone out of the Champions League, which they were so good in before, and in cups where they've gone out of the Italian Cup too. So yeah, it's just really, really hard to sustain that without having all the depth and getting everything right every single game.
At the point where we previewed the round of 16, Michael, Bayern Munich had been smashing panic buttons after being beaten by Leverkusen in the league. Then they went and lost 1-0 at the Stadio Olimpico in the first leg against Lazio, but 3-1 in the end. How convincing was their second leg turnaround?
I don't know if it was convincing, actually. I still don't think they're a particularly good side. I don't think they've got the patterns of play you expect of a Bayern Munich. I mean, Lazio had a very good chance to double their lead at 0-0 with Immobile, who missed a chance at the far post. Bayern were okay. I thought their fullbacks were very prominent getting forward. Kimmich on the right, and Guerrero in particular was drifting inside into good positions. I almost always want to call him Grimaldo these days because they're kind of similar players from left back and similar names. But I thought the story here was just the fact that Harry Kane scored twice and Thomas Müller scored once. And when you look at how the goals came, the first Kane goal was a shot that he diverted in. The Müller goal was a shot that he diverted in. And the second Kane goal was a rebound. And we talk these days about the shifting nature of centre forwards, but Bayern almost have two poachers there. Mm. I mean, two players who, of course, they've got other qualities. I'd say probably Kane more so, despite playing as the number nine. But they're two players who, they are slightly inexplicable in how good they are at finding space and knowing where to be in the penalty area. And quite often, I mean, I think it's quite rare the best team wins the Champions League. I think often it comes down to really fine margins and teams who get the job done. And we've said it so much about Real Madrid, you know, boosted by Cristiano Ronaldo and Karim Benzema over the years. And those two can get goals from almost nowhere. So I think that's the relevant thing going forward for this competition. The other side of the coin is that Lazio was so bad that Maurizio Sarri has resigned after nearly 3 years in charge. They're ninth in the league. They've really struggled to kind of, you know, it's the classic thing when a club's in the European competition, often the league form dip significantly. The thing I like about this is that I read a report where the three candidates potentially lined up to take over are Christian Brocchi, Miroslav Klose, and Tommaso Rocchi, all former Lazio players. Mm. So they're really going for the, you know the club angle after a guy like Sarri who comes in, and I think regardless of what club he's at, he doesn't really make any effort to get to know the club. It's Sarri's way or you're off. So yeah, I quite like that little detail.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Pressure on Paris Saint-Germain, as there always is, into the knockout rounds of this competition. Liam, they got past Real Sociedad 4-1 in the end, but it was tactically interesting. Real Sociedad in particular, a fun watch.
Yeah, well, I got this completely wrong. So there's a tweet from myself on the 18th of December after the tie was announced. I said PSG are 100% getting pressed into a 3-0 away defeat in Real Sociedad, which is already wrong because obviously it's San Sebastian, the place. Luis Enrique will be stubborn and continue to play out, and they'll give up way too many turnovers. I know PSG have him as a project coach, but can they take a third last 16 exit in a row? In my defence, he actually changed tactically quite a bit. There wasn't sort of the same stubborn 4-3-3 build-up we've seen a lot of. He took Ugarte out of the sort of deepest midfield role, who'd been a bit of a problem for them, particularly in sort of transitions, actually, making a lot of fouls, really just not quite being up to speed. It was a really interesting kind of 4-3-1-2. The important point being Ousmane Dembele played in the 10 rather than being off the right-hand side. And Mbappe and Bradley Barcola were these split strikers, which was just really, really good fun. They were able to make lots of runs in behind. The opening goal actually comes from them pressing really high, really well. They pressed out of this sort of a... They had three at the back and pushed Achraf Hakimi further forward to press the fullback, basically locked up all the options. And when they made the regain, Mbappe was in position just to basically get a straight through ball into him. Again, Mbappe's ended up being the match winner. But I thought they were a lot better in build-up. Real Sociedad pressed them incredibly well at the Parc des Princes. An awful lot of high turnovers. They really struggled and relied on Dembele to sort of break the game open. But this time he was basically just dropping in really, really deep, almost the edge of his own box. And they then would have a number eight or a midfielder running in the other direction to try and get out and pull someone in and work off of sort of opposite movements. So the fact that this was largely quite boring from when they opened the scoring in terms of all being quite controlled. Mm-hmm. There was a late flurry from Larreal, but nothing sort of significant. It's the first time since 2015-16 that PSG have won both legs of a Champions League knockout game. And given how bad their record's been at this sort of stage, I thought it was a really, really big statement. And with their youngest team in a Champions League game was pretty good for Luis Enrique.
That sounds like an interesting tactical scheme from Luis Enrique. It will be stress tested in the quarterfinals, that's for sure. Michael, Barca and Napoli was framed as two title winners from last season that had dropped off pretty hard this season, particularly domestically. How did the match look on the European stage?
Yeah, the first game, I thought Barcelona were very poor. I mean, both teams were poor, to be honest, but I thought Barcelona's problem in the first game was that they just didn't offer any proper width, particularly down the left. So they're playing Lamine Yamal on the right, coming inside onto his left foot. Obviously very dangerous, slightly inexperienced and not always making the right decision, as you expect for a guy of his age. But on the left, they had Pedri coming inside from wide left, and it meant they just didn't stretch the play at all. The only width they had from the left was João Cancelo, who was always trying to do his cross with the outside of his right foot thing, which when it comes off looks great. When it doesn't, just looks completely pathetic. So obviously, for the second leg, Pedri was out because Pedri's injured. And that meant that they had to do something different and they used Rafinha down the left. I must admit, I haven't seen him that much down the left. I think of him playing the role coming inside from the right. But with Yamal doing really well there, he's had to find another role. And he was actually really good. He stretched the play. They had proper width. He played a role in both the first two goals, one of which was scored by Cancelo. So he can be, of course, a threat from the left.
Is that an open play goal?
It was, yeah, a rebound that was turned down by Cancelo.
Outside the boot.
But as it,
outside the boot?
Don't think it was. Nice showboating for that one.
So with Rafinha, you know, holding the width on the left-hand side, does that give Cancelo, you know, able to take up more, maybe more awkward positions for the opposition, even if it reduces his options of outside of the right foot crosses, but in that sort of half space?
I think that was a little bit the case, yeah. But I just think you need to stretch the play. You need to stretch the defence. You need to create gaps to play through because they can do that. The third goal scored by Lewandowski was absolutely fantastic move. I thought the other interesting thing from the second leg was it was an interesting game for centre-backs. Barcelona used a 17-year-old Kubasi, who I really was not aware of at centre-back, but he looked excellent. He's got a turn of speed. His passing range is very good. Our Barcelona correspondent, Laia Cervejo Herrero, did a very good article on his rise and Xavi having faith in him to play him ahead of a few more experienced players in such a big game. And the other interesting thing about centre-backs was the goal Napoli scored in Barcelona, which was by Romani, because it was bizarre. He just waltzed forward from the back, played a pass out to the right. No one was marking him. Pushed into the box and finished. And you just don't expect that from a centre-back, but I absolutely loved it.
Barca's out-of-possession scheme there, obviously falling apart somewhat after what is now quite a basic approach of centre-back stepping forward. Most teams are able to handle that at this stage, but maybe that's a bit of a flaw in Barca heading into the quarterfinals. So many exciting young players, though, to watch, hopefully. And finally, Dortmund against PSV. Mark, was billed as the most even tie in the knockouts, and we hoped would be quite open and entertaining, two teams probably going at it. Is that what happened?
Yeah, statistically the most even, and on the pitch, it was pretty even throughout. There was a chance at the very end from Luke de Jong that could have equalised in the tie and sent it to extra time, but he completely fluffed his lines. But I must say, across the two legs, I was fairly disappointed with the quality as much as anything on show. There was a lot of back and forth in both games. If you look at the match momentum, which I know that we've spoken about before in this podcast, it's quite clearly that Dortmund had the first half and PSV had the second half, and they had to because they needed to come back into the game. But I thought there was a lot of sloppiness in possession at times from both sides, giving it away too easy. And I looked at the number of possessions, plural, so how many times the ball changes hands, and the game had 108 in total, which was the most for either side in the Champions League this season. And I don't think it was necessarily because of really high pressing and forcing errors. I think it was more down to poor quality at times. And I was quite disappointed going into it, obviously thinking that PSV were the highest scorers in the top seven European leagues. They're averaging 3.1 goals per 90 in the Eredivisie this season, and they were still quite wasteful in front of goal. And that was a little bit disappointing for me. I thought I really wanted to look at Johan Bakayoko, who's been spoken about so widely, maybe potentially having a move away from PSV this summer. And he's a good player. I don't think he's a great player. Maybe he's got a very good highlights reel, but there was a few occasions where he got into good opportunities, or got into good positions, I should say, and just his final product was a little bit weak, I'd say. But Dortmund got through, which is ultimately the main narrative, and they do have some really strong attacking players, of course, with Julian Brandt and Daniel Marlin, and Marco Reus came off the bench and scored, and obviously Jadon Sancho being one of the key narratives. He's now getting up to speed, scored the goal, and he scored at the weekend as well against Werder Bremen. But I do think ultimately whoever draws Dortmund arguably has the easiest opponents in the quarterfinals. I looked at it statistically as well in terms of Opta's power rankings, and it's actually Atleti who are statistically the weakest. But I think, as we've spoken about, they're more likely to cause problems for teams. But I do think that Dortmund haven't had the strongest league campaign anyway. They've actually done well in Europe, as sort of contrary to their league form. But I do think that whoever draws them will have potentially the easiest opponents of all.
I'd like, before we go, to put together the Athletic Football Tactics podcast Champions League power rankings, if you don't mind, if it's not too beneath you guys. I think I'll start by putting Manchester City at the top. And from what Mark said, and I think a nod of agreement from Michael, Dortmund in eighth. Mm-hmm. In between that is quite interesting, which contains Arsenal, Bayern, Barcelona, Real Madrid, PSG and Atletico Madrid. A lot of those names we had questions about heading into the round of 16. And based on what you guys have said, some of them have answered them more definitively than others. Why don't we start at seventh place in our power rankings? I'd like to put forward Atletico Madrid and possibly even Barca at this stage. Michael?
Yeah, Barcelona for me. I just don't think they're a great side. I always trust Atletico will be tactically intelligent, flexible, get the job done, good home atmosphere, which I'm not sure is the case with Barcelona in this unusual stadium they're playing in this season. I think Barcelona and Dortmund would be the two I'd want to go.
Would you have Atletico Madrid above anyone other than Dortmund or Barcelona?
Tempted to say possibly Bayern.
Okay.
If we're talking about right now, looking as a cohesive team, a cohesive unit, rather, there's broader off-field problems for Bayern and managerial bits and pieces. And as Michael was saying, not necessarily a convincing win. I think there's one thing Atleti did probably look at. It was definitely convincing in the second leg. But then I'd also be writing off Harry Kane and Thomas Müller and players that are capable of scoring goals. And the moments players you want in both boxes, as I often say. It's not just about between the boxes, it's having those match winners. So I'd probably put them on an even keel right now.
Okay. Mark, Michael, should we have Bayern just above Atletico Madrid?
Probably. I think then starting to bring PSG into the conversation, despite the valid points about individual quality, and we know that Mbappe can score out of nothing, I'd then start to say between Bayern and PSG from there on in.
Yeah, okay. I'd put them level, Bayern, PSG.
I'm going to put Bayern above Atletico, above Barcelona, above Dortmund. So, Michael, I need you really to pick between PSG and Bayern for what will be fourth spot in the power rankings?
I actually think Bayern are all right. I think their problems have been massively exaggerated based upon the fact in the league they're up against a really, really good team. They didn't play well in the first leg against Lazio, but yeah, I think they get the job done. I'd go Bayern ahead of PSG.
And they've got these penalty box executors in Kane and Müller, as you discussed. PSG, a very young side, to pull at another thread of Champions League experience that we've discussed. So Arsenal and Real Madrid battling for second spot in our power rankings. We're going to let that drift into space and someone can pick it
Real
up.
Real Madrid a second.
That's not a contest. You can't put Arsenal. Phenomenal defensively, and that's why I'd say they deserve to be so high up on that list against teams that have got better goal scorers, more experience, more history of going, you know, deep in this competition. The same, even managerially, Arteta is still learning. And they're, of course, juggling this with a title race, which other teams might not necessarily be doing. But yeah, I think you can't look past Real Madrid in that.
One thing on the Arsenal game against Porto, mainly in the first leg, was that there were so many fouls and the game was broken up so much. And I sort of saw that as like potential, and it was actually Arsenal who were committing the fouls. I saw that as a bit of naivety from Arsenal, maybe getting lacking a few street smarts, shall we say, and not necessarily delving into the dark arts. And if Arsenal were to come up against Real Madrid in the next round or potentially the round after that, that I think Real Madrid are just the masters at that. So I think the experience and the dark arts that Real Madrid could play is why I think they'll continue to go far in every competition.
Okay, so not total agreement through here. Some interesting discussions and not a lot between a lot of these sides. But for posterity's sake, heading into the quarterfinals, the Athletic Football Tactics podcast Champions League power rankings is as such: Manchester City number one, Real Madrid number two, Arsenal and Bayern third and fourth. And then we've got PSG followed by Atletico Madrid and then Barcelona and Dortmund. It will be very interesting to see what the quarterfinal draw chucks up. And we'll be with you all the way through the knockout rounds of this Champions League. It's going to be absolutely fascinating. And our job, as it was today, will be to try and cut through a lot of the noise and try and give you the best football analysis of this year's Champions League knockout. So thank you to Mark, Michael and Liam for doing that with me, Ali Maxwell, today. Make sure you subscribe to this podcast feed and to The Athletic as well. Join The Athletic today. Head to theathletic.com/tactics for a discount on an annual subscription. And do join us again next week on The Athletic Football Tactics podcast.
The Athletic.